weapons was strictly regulated. The marchers should have been incapable of doing anything other than running for their lives or dying when his men shot them down like dogs. And he certainly hadn't anticipated the soldiers opening fire on his men. The Heer might have its doubts over what his unit did, but they understood its value.
"Return fire," he snapped.
The army was in revolt. It was the only explanation. Thankfully, the SS existed to keep the army in line.
"Kill them all."
A bullet slammed into his chest. Victor stumbled and fell, just as another bullet cracked into his skull. He was dead before he hit the ground. Kurt had always wondered just how the Berlin Guard would do against a crack unit of the Waffen-SS. The SS certainly boasted of their fighting prowess. Conrad had certainly been happy to insist that they were unrivaled on the battlefield. But the unit that had fired on unarmed civilians had disintegrated under the first salvo. He had expected more of a fight, honestly. Men experienced in counterinsurgency warfare should take into account, he thought, the prospect of suddenly coming under fire from an unexpected direction. But the SS had melted away, leaving him with an unexpected problem. He'd just killed the CO and slaughtered an SS detachment. What the hell did he do now? A man lurched out of the pile of marchers and stumbled towards him, blood trickling down his face. Kurt almost shot the newcomer before he recognized him. Volker Schulze, Conrad's father. The man had been a factory foreman, if Kurt recalled correctly. If rumors were to be believed, he was also one of the unionists. And yet, he'd also been an SS officer before retiring to civilian life.
"Kurt," Schulze said.
It was suddenly easy to believe the man had been a soldier.
"Get your men organized. We need to take the Reichstag."
Kurt stared at him. "The Reichstag?"
"Yes," Schulze insisted. "We have to stop the SS before they do something stupid. I'm getting everyone who has military experience lined up, but they don't have any weapons."
"I've just started a civil war," Kurt thought numbly. Had any unit mutinied so badly since the dark days of 1918? And he'd taken the lead. "They'll kill me when they catch me." Training took over.
"Jawohl," he said.
Schulze was a good man, and he was right. They could take the Reichstag and force the government to surrender before it was too late.
"I'll get my men organized now."
The troops mutinied?"
"Yes, Herr Reichsführer," the observer said. He had to speak loudly to be heard over the alarm echoing through the building. "The Berlin Guard opened fire on Sturmbannführer Harden's men. They have been scattered while the guardsmen prepare to storm the building." Karl had to fight to keep his expression under control. He'd expected a quick slaughter followed by a long period of cleaning the blood from the streets and purging the politicians and activists who'd brought Germany low. But now, all of a sudden, it dawned on him that he might have made a deadly mistake. He was no coward. The thought of dying for the Reich held no terrors for him, but everything could be lost along with him. He'd been careful not to anoint a successor, knowing it would cause problems in the future, and yet, that too had been a mistake. If he died, there would be a power struggle within the SS at the worst possible moment. "I can't allow myself to die," he thought. He knew just what the crowd would do to anyone they caught within the Reichstag. Now the myth of the government's invincibility had been shattered once and for all. "And I cannot let the Reich Council make any more mistakes." He rose.
"Have my security detail escort me to the helipad," he said.
There was always a helicopter ready and waiting, just in case the Reich Council needed to leave in a hurry.
"And then send out a message on the emergency channels. Condition Wilhelm. I say again, Condition Wilhelm."
"Jawohl, Herr Reichsführer," the observer said.
Karl cursed savagely as he hurried out of the office and into the antechamber,
where a trio of heavily armed stormtroopers were waiting for him. Condition Wilhelm was a coup, to all intents and purposes. SS officers and infantry on thousands of military bases would take control and put the bases into lockdown, ensuring the mutiny couldn't spread. And, by the time the dust had settled, the SS would be in complete control of Germany. But there hadn't been time to make all the preparations. "And word will be spreading," he thought. He wondered briefly if he had time to lead the way to the council chamber and execute the councillors, starting with the damned finance minister. But he knew he didn't dare. "They'll be screaming to the Heer, telling them to join the mutiny and turn on the SS."
"Herr Reichsführer," the lead stormtrooper said.
He carried a rifle in one hand, held at the ready.
"The building has gone into lockdown. The corridors are clear."
"Excellent,"
Karl said, checking the pistol at his belt. He wasn't the only one with a security detail, but the SS controlled the building. Everyone else would, hopefully, be running around in confusion while he made his exit.
"Take me to the helicopter."
"Jawohl, Herr Reichsführer,"
the stormtrooper said. Gudrun had thought the last protest was bad, but this was a nightmare. She stood as soon as Horst rolled off her, yet she almost wished she hadn't as she glanced around, taking in the horrors surrounding her. Hundreds of dead bodies lay on the ground, while the wounded were screaming for help, help she feared would never come. Even the sight of the soldiers finishing off the remains of the SS was no consolation. She'd led the dead and wounded to meet their doom. She swallowed hard, wondering if anyone would still listen to her, and cleared her throat.
"If you're not wounded, start helping those who are," she shouted.
Thankfully, the BDM had taught basic first aid, even if it had been more focused on helping children than adults. She silently promised herself she'd thank her tutors if she survived the day.
"Bandage their wounds. Sort out who can be saved."
Her eyes caught sight of a boy she knew to be a skilled runner.
"Get to the nearest hospital," she ordered,
hoping he wasn't too stunned. None of the students had any real experience with uncontrolled violence.
"Tell them we need doctors and ambulances out here now."
Horst grabbed her arm.
"Send someone to the nearest computer station," he ordered. "We have to spread the word."
Gudrun stared at him wildly.
"We have spread the word," she said. "And look what happened."
"It's going to get worse," Horst said. "You know what the SS will do if the bastards have a chance to rally. The military needs to be warned."
Hermann hurried onto Victory Square with the remainder of the police reinforcements and stopped in horror at the sight that greeted him. Dead bodies, wounded students and adults. It was like stepping into a war zone. And they were Germans, not Untermenschen. He looked at the soldiers, readying themselves for an assault on the Reichstag, and the bodies of the SS men lying where they'd fallen, and knew civil war had begun. The soldiers wouldn't have attacked the SS unless they'd stepped well over the line.
"Get in touch with the station," he ordered.
The captain was nowhere to be seen, unsurprisingly. He probably couldn't decide which side to take and was hiding, rather than commit himself.
"Tell them to send all the medics they can find."
He caught sight of Gudrun and shivered. His daughter seemed unharmed, but her white shirt was stained with blood, and she was organizing the students to take care of the wounded. He wanted to drag her away from the scene, yet he knew it was far too late. Gudrun had asserted her independence, no matter what he thought about it. He looked up at the brooding Reichstag. A sniper could easily start raining bullets down on the crowd, and then reminded himself it was time to take a side.
"And warn them to arrest any SS officers in eyesight, too," he added.
He glanced up as a helicopter lifted off from the building's roof and vanished into the distance. Thankfully, either it wasn't armed, or the pilot thought the soldiers had anti-aircraft missiles on hand.
"It's the only hope of preventing a civil war."
Hans was in shock. He'd been tricked, he saw now,
And the hell of it was that he'd practically tricked himself. He had been so grateful for Holliston's support for the budget cuts that he hadn't really considered why Holliston had supported him. He'd seen one reason. Holliston did have something to gain from budget cuts. But he hadn't seen the other. Holliston had deliberately provoked a protest march, which he'd then turned into a massacre. And even he didn't expect to see the Berlin Guard turn on the SS, Hans thought. The whole world had been turned upside down.
"He's gone," Voss said.
The building was in lockdown, but the military security detachments were trying to open a pathway to safety for the Reich Council.
"Left his secretary and ran for the helicopter."
Hans closed his eyes in bitter pain as a low rumble ran through the building. There was no point in trying to escape, not now. The secret passageways led directly to the various ministries dotted around Victory Square, but the mob had the streets under control already, even if they hadn't stormed the buildings themselves. They'd counted on using the helicopter to escape Berlin if the Americans launched a surprise attack, and Holliston had beaten them to it. It was impossible to escape the feeling that the SS Reichsführer had intended to cause a riot and leave his comrades to die.
"I managed to get a brief message out to the nearest garrison," Voss added. "They'll warn the rest of the Reich about the SS."
The building shook again. Hans sighed and sat down, wondering just what would happen when the mutineers burst into the chamber. It wouldn't be long now. Kurt had no idea what sort of opposition would await his men in the Reichstag. But there was no time to do more than the most basic planning before knocking down the gates and swarming the building. Several of his men had vanished in the chaos. A number of policemen had offered to bring up the rear, including, he was surprised to see, his own father. Kurt ordered them to be ready to take prisoners, then led the way into the building. There was almost no opposition, save for a pair of SS troopers who were blasted out with thrown grenades after they made a stand. Kurt couldn't help being glad the murdering bastards he'd killed hadn't been anything like as determined to hold the line.
"Hands on your heads," he bellowed, as they cleared the ground floor and made their way up to the next level. "Get the prisoners down to the halls and leave them there under guard."
There was no further resistance as they slipped further and further up the building. Kurt couldn't help being astonished by the sheer opulence of the decorations, including hundreds of artworks he'd only seen in books, and just how quickly the low-level bureaucrats surrendered when they saw the soldiers. The building was solid enough to ensure that a determined defense could hold it for quite some time, particularly when the intruders had no idea which corridor led where. But he was grateful for the lack of resistance, right up until they broke onto the highest level. A hail of fire greeted the soldiers as they climbed up the stairway.
"Surrender!" Kurt shouted.
A handful of grenades would be more than sufficient to clear the way.
"Give up now, and you won't be harmed."
There was a long pause. Then someone shouted back,
"What about the Reich Council?"
"They will not be harmed either, provided they surrender," Kurt said.
He had no idea if he was authorized to make any such promises. It wasn't as if they had a command authority. But it would encourage them to surrender without further delay.
"Tell them to give up, and they will remain unharmed."
He muttered orders to his men as he waited for a reply. God alone knew what sort of equipment the Reich Council had on hand. They could be calling for help, even now, although the Berlin Guard itself was the closest military unit to the city, unless, of course, the Waffen-SS had another division on hand. He didn't think there were any closer than Warsaw, but he hadn't thought the SS would bring a police unit from Germany East to Berlin Center.
"They want to negotiate," the voice shouted finally.
Kurt shook his head. It sounded like a delaying tactic to him.
"They can surrender now, or we'll force our way into the chamber," he said. "You have 5 minutes to decide."
He braced himself, unsure just what to expect. The Reich Council didn't seem to have expected trouble, not if they were gathered in the Reichstag rather than observing events from a safe distance. Indeed, if the SS hadn't opened fire, there probably wouldn't have been any trouble. Everything he'd seen suggested that the Reich Council had been as surprised as the Berlin Guard. Although, there was the lingering question of just who'd been in that helicopter.
"They would like to surrender, but they insist on talking to the dissident leaders," the voice said after 4 minutes. "Is that acceptable?"
"Fine," Kurt said. Volker could talk to them. He'd been in control of the unions, after all. He was probably the most powerful man in the dissident movement.
"We're coming up now, so put your weapons on the ground and step away from them."
He forced himself to walk up the stairs, unsure of what he'd see when he reached the top. A handful of soldiers wearing combat battle dress, close protection specialists, he guessed, and a couple of civilians, looking nervous. They were rapidly cuffed as Kurt led the way into the next room, where a dozen men waited for him. The Führer and Field Marshal Voss were instantly recognizable. Their portraits hung in the barracks. But the others were strangers.
"This is an outrage, soldier," the other field marshal said. "Stand down at once and—"
"So is ordering troops to fire on innocent civilians," Kurt snapped.
He lifted his rifle and gestured threateningly.
"If any of you are carrying any weapons, say so now."
He gave them a moment, then jerked his rifle barrel, indicating they were to rise.
"You will be kept separately from the other prisoners until we have decided your final disposition," he said.
He had no idea what would be the best thing to do with the former Reich Council. That, too, was best left to Volker and Gudrun.
"Do not attempt to speak without permission, or you will be shot."
And if they do regain power, he thought morbidly, as his men searched the uppermost level and marked offices as temporary cells, "they'll have problems deciding precisely which of my crimes to put on my execution warrant." It felt like hours before Gudrun could take a rest. Horst by her side, she had thrown herself into helping the wounded and preparing the dead for honorable burial. It had been a nightmare. The streets were slippery with blood. But there had been no choice. Someone had to take charge and deal with the chaos. By the time Kurt, wearing his combat uniform, came to find her, she was tired and cranky.
"Gudrun," Kurt said.
He looked around, then back at her.
"If I'd known this would happen when I helped you sneak into a hospital—"
"She did the right thing," Horst said. He somehow managed to sound fresh.
"The government had to be beaten."
Kurt gave him a sharp look.
"And how much of the country do we control?"
"Good question," Gudrun said. She rose and peered at her brother.
"Who's in charge right now?"
"Conrad's father," Kurt said. "He wants to see you."
"I'm coming," Gudrun said.
"Horst?"
"I'll come with you," Horst said, "if you'll still have me."
Gudrun slipped her hand into his.
"I wouldn't miss it for the world."
She sobered as she followed her brother through the remains of the gates and into the building. She'd never been inside, and part of her was quietly fascinated, a feeling that faded as she realized just how much of the country's wealth had been lavished on the building while large parts of the population barely had enough to eat. Hundreds of prisoners, their hands cuffed, sat in the hallway, looking at the floor despondently. It was easy to tell that they expected to be shot out of hand.
"They stole the artwork from all over the Reich,"
Horst commented quietly, as they walked up the stairs.
"Hermann Göring used to collect pieces of irreplaceable art. When he died, his family passed it to the Reich Council."
Gudrun nodded. She wasn't surprised.
"Gudrun," Volker Schulze said.
He was standing alone in a large war room, covered with maps of Germany and the Reich.
"Did you know what you'd start?"
"No,"
Gudrun said. How much did he know? Kurt could have told him she'd known about Conrad long before anyone else. No, he merely thought she'd pushed him into using his contacts to check up on his son.
"I didn't."
"But you started this," Volker Schulze said.
He waved a hand at one of the maps.
"You can now help me clean up the mess."
Chapter 38. SS Deployment Base, Reichstag, Germany. 21-22 August, 1985. It had not been a comfortable flight. Carl Holliston had hoped to fly directly to the Reich command bunker in East Germany, or perhaps loop round Berlin and head to Wewelsburg Castle, but the endless series of confused reports on the radio made it sound dangerous. There were outbreaks of fighting at military and SS bases, mutinies on the high seas, and even clashes between jet fighters. If, of course, the radio could be believed. Carl was sure that most of the reports were badly exaggerated. He'd been taught there was always a period of confusion when something happened without warning. But it was hard to know for sure. The Heer might be divided, yet he had no doubt that the Kriegsmarine and the Luftwaffe would side with the rebels. They'd been infected with rebel propaganda right from the start. He gritted his teeth as the helicopter, running on fumes, dropped towards the SS deployment base. SS Skorzeny had been preparing for its deployment to South Africa and, he cursed in frustration, most of its equipment had been boxed for transport. The unit, the only wholly reliable unit west of Poland, would need time, more time than he had, to prepare for a full-scale attack on Berlin. He grunted as the helicopter hit the pad, then staggered to his feet and hurried to the hatch. The ground crew were already moving in to secure the helicopter and refuel the craft. Behind them, a uniformed officer waited.
Herr Reichsführer, SS Obergruppenführer Felix Kortig said, as Carl clambered out of the helicopter.
In the distance, the sun was setting over the mountains, and darkness was falling over the land.
We have a briefing for you in the situation room.
Good, Carl said. Perhaps, just perhaps, the situation wasn't as bad as it seemed.
Have some coffee brought to the room, too. We're going to need it.
He allowed Kortig to lead him into the base, barely noticing the stormtroopers standing guard at the doors. The entire garrison had gone into lockdown, although, as far as they were from civilian towns or military bases, it was unlikely there was any immediate danger. But that would change, he reminded himself, as they passed through a pair of armored doors and into the situation room. The deployment base was hardly a secret.
I have two companies on readiness, Kortig informed him, and a third picketing all the approaches. However, most of our equipment is already en route to South Africa.
I know, Carl said, cutting him off. He wasn't in the mood for excuses.
I need a situation briefing right now.
He took a seat as an orderly entered carrying a tray of coffee. Behind him, a young analyst stepped into the room looking pale. He seemed too young to wear SS black, Carl noted. The young troopers seemed to get younger every year. Carl felt a sudden flicker of wistfulness for his younger days, when all that mattered was getting the job done, which he pushed aside savagely. He might have made mistakes. Bad rolls of the dice were inevitable, but the contest for supremacy in the Reich was far from over.
Herr Reichsführer, the analyst said.
Most of our communications network has been badly damaged. What reports we have are often imprecise or wildly exaggerated. However, we do have a picture of just what's been happening over the last few hours.
Carl nodded impatiently, sipping his coffee.
The police and military bases in Berlin itself seem to have gone over to the rebels, the analyst continued. I was able to speak briefly to an officer in the RSHA, Herr Reichsführer. He confirmed that the building was surrounded and on the verge of being stormed. None of the other SS installations within Berlin responded to our calls. They may simply be isolated, or they may have been overwhelmed.
He paused, waiting for Carl's response.
Outside Berlin, the situation is confused. A number of military bases turned into war zones as our forces attempted to take control of the troops, provoking the soldiers to mutiny.
At last report, Herr Reichsführer,
most of the military bases in Germany Prime are probably in rebel hands. However, as it is clear the rebels didn't plan for an uprising, they may be as uncertain of what's actually going on as ourselves. It will take them at least a week, I suspect, to re-establish a chain of command and decide what to do next. Germany East remains solidly in our hands.
The Heer units within Germany East are seemingly unaware of anything happening to the West, Herr Reichsführer. Germany North, Germany Arabia, and Germany South are so far quiet. But Germany South may declare for the rebels when they finally work out what's going on. We are not particularly popular there.
Karl sipped his coffee thoughtfully.
And the forces in South Africa?
No word, the analyst said.
I don't know which way they'll jump. Keep monitoring the situation and inform me if there are any major changes, Karl ordered, looking at the map.
The deployment base was looking alarmingly exposed. How long would it take the rebels to deduce where he'd fled?
Not long, he suspected, if some of the Reich Council joined the rebellion.
How many men can you send to Berlin?
Kortig frowned.
Right now, 25 at most, he said. We only have 4 assault helicopters fueled up and ready to fly. The transport aircraft we were planning to use for Operation Headshot are already in Germany East. If we had a few days to make preparations...
We don't have a few days, Karl said.
Right now, the rebels controlled Berlin, and Berlin alone. Given time, that would change rapidly.
We need to launch a strike as quickly as possible and kill the rebel leadership.
That would be tricky, Kortig observed. Berlin is not exactly undefended.
Right now the defenses are confused, Karl argued. We can slip 4 helicopters back into Berlin and attack the Reichstag.
There isn't time to mount the operation under cover of darkness, Kortig said. By the time the helicopters reached Berlin, the sun would be rising. We'll have to launch the attack tomorrow night.
He was right, Karl knew, even though it was bitterly frustrating. 25 men, even Skorzeny commandos, would be hellishly exposed if they tried to launch an attack in broad daylight. The rebels would probably have already moved mobile anti-aircraft missile launchers into Berlin if they were expecting an immediate counterattack. It was what he would have done. Sending the troops in daylight was asking for disaster. And yet, he asked himself, just how badly can they damage the Reich in a day?
Start making preparations, he ordered.
If the assault failed, if the rebel leadership survived, they'd have to prepare a far more elaborate response.
And make contact with our forces in Germany East. We have to prepare for war.
Jawohl, Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said.
Under other circumstances, Hans would have savored the thought of being locked up in one of his own offices. The rebels had searched it, removed everything that could be used as a weapon, and then told him not to try to leave the chamber on pain of death. Hans hadn't tried to argue. Instead, he'd sat down as the door was closed and tried to get some sleep. There was no point in doing anything else. If he tried to escape and succeeded, where would he go? He was half asleep when someone opened the door, but the sound jerked him awake instantly. A pair of soldiers stood there, looking down at him. Hans braced himself, wondering if he was simply going to be taken outside and shot, then rose to his feet, ready to meet his death with dignity. The soldiers searched him, again, and then escorted him through the network of corridors into a small office. Volker Schulze, instantly recognizable from the files on Union activists, was sitting behind a table looking tired. A large mug of coffee was perched in front of him.
Herr Schulze, Hans said.
It was hard to keep the bitterness out of his voice. It had been hard enough trying to save the economy without the unions driving up costs and limiting production, but he had tried.
What can I do for you?
Schulze looked up at him.
Answer me a question, he said. Where do your loyalties lie?
With the Reich, Hans said flatly. He had no objection to enriching himself at the same time as building the Reich's economy, but there were limits. It was a constant headache. It had been a constant headache, that others didn't seem to recognize those limits.
Where do yours lie?
With the Reich, Schulze said.
Your subordinates speak highly of you, Herr Kruger.
Thank you, Hans said.
He'd played the political game long enough to have a very good idea of where the conversation was leading.
You want me to run the economy for you.
Schulze didn't bother to pretend to be surprised.
Most of the ministries haven't had time to slip into disarray, he said instead.
Bureaucrats weren't murdered, save for a handful who were killed to pay off old grudges. Files weren't destroyed, even in the RSHA.
We need those ministries in working order just to take control of the Reich.
Hans nodded.
And how much do you control right now?
Not as much as we'd like, Schulze admitted.
He smiled rather darkly.
I should tell you that the Reichsführer sentenced you to death. The police unit that fired on the protesters had orders to sweep the Reichstag afterwards, capturing or killing the Reich Council. You would simply have been killed out of hand.
I wish I could say I was surprised, Hans said.
Holliston, damn the man, had clearly had his own plans for taking advantage of the chaos. Hans had thought Holliston respected the balance of power. The SS might not have come out ahead if the balance had shattered, but the protests had already crippled the Reich.
He always was a ruthless bastard.
Schulze nodded in agreement.
You have two choices, Herr Kruger, he said.
You can join us and help us to build a new government, or you can refuse, whereupon you will be moved to a detention facility until you can be tried afterwards for your role on the Reich Council.
I thought I was doing the right thing, Hans protested without heat. Legally.
Legal is what the people in power say it is, Schulze snapped.
You taught the entire Reich that lesson, Herr Kruger.
He paused.
I might add that the Reichsführer and the SS are unlikely to roll over and play dead for us, he warned. You may be taken from our detention center and thrown into an SS detention center if we lose the war.
I have no illusions about what they'll do to me, Hans said.
Holliston had a whole string of grudges to pay off.
Or you, if you lose.
It wasn't a hard choice. The prospect of being put on trial chilled him to the bone. He understood the value of scapegoats. The Reich Council had turned quite a few people into scapegoats merely for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the rebels, if they used him as a scapegoat for the Reich's ills, could draw some political advantage out of his death. He'd done the best he could, he knew, but the population wouldn't see it that way. The Unionists alone had good reasons to want him dead.
And Holliston wants me deader, he thought wryly.
The rebels would probably shoot him out of hand, but the SS would torture him first, then slaughter his entire family. Joining the rebels is the only hope for any kind of survival.
I'll join you, he said simply.
Glad to hear it, Schulze said. You can have some sleep. Then you start work tomorrow morning. By then, hopefully, we should have a clear idea of just what's going on.
Hans shuddered. It was possible, he supposed, that most of the military would join the rebels, just like the Berlin Guard. But it was equally impossible that Holliston would take control of the entire Reich, save for Berlin itself. If that happened, the city would come under siege, and no one, not even newborn children, would be spared the consequences when it finally fell. He might just have joined the losing side. But it doesn't matter, he told himself as the guards reappeared. I'm dead anyway. He frowned.
If I may ask, he said, what happened to the Führer?
He's going to make a nice speech handing over power to the provisional government, Schulze said. And then he's going to go into exile. There's nothing to be gained by killing him.
I suppose not, Hans agreed.
He had no particular dislike of the Führer. Besides, killing him would give the SS a martyr they could use for their propaganda.
He was always a harmless fool.
Gudrun, Hermann said as he entered the office.
It had taken him nearly an hour to work up the nerve.
Can I have a word?
His daughter looked tired, too tired. She didn't have any experience in administration. Hardly anyone did outside the bureaucracy, but she was doing her best. Hermann couldn't help wondering just how long she'd keep the post. Even though she'd been a student leader, there were others who were far more experienced. And yet...
Yes, Father, Gudrun said.
She sounded tired, too. She'd changed her shirt at some point, but she looked as though she needed a shower and several hours of sleep.
What can I do for you?
I just wanted to say I'm proud of you,
Hermann said, closing the door behind him.
And of your brother.
It could have gone very badly without him, Father, Gudrun said.
She waved him to a chair in front of her desk, pushing her paperwork to one side.
And you.
Hermann nodded. He'd believed in the new order, he'd believed in the state, but, in the end, the state had tried to gun down his daughter and thousands of innocent Germans. And his entire family had turned against the state. How could he argue with his wife, his daughter, and all three of his sons?
I do wish you hadn't done it, Hermann said.
The thought of his daughter in jail, or hanging naked from meat hooks under the RSHA, or being raped to death was terrifying. Even now, even after the regime had been crippled, he still shivered at the thought. He shook his head, unable to find the words. His father had told him that there would come a time when he'd look at his daughter and see a different person. But he hadn't believed the old man until now. Gudrun was no longer a girl or a young woman. She was an adult who'd taken her destiny into her own hands. He still wanted to protect her, but he could no longer try to control her life.
It had to be done, Gudrun said stiffly. I wrote those leaflets.
Yes, it did, Hermann said, and I'm proud of you for doing it, but I wish it hadn't been you.
He blinked in surprise as he registered what she'd said.
You wrote those leaflets?
I did, Gudrun said.
She met his eyes with a defiant stare that reminded Hermann once again of his own mother. Gudrun's grandmother had never taken any backtalk from her son when he'd been a child.
I lied to you, father, but I'm not sorry.
Hermann shook his head. A month ago, he would have exploded with rage. He hadn't raised his children to lie to him, even if they did have to be less than honest with their teachers and the BDM matrons. Now he understood. Gudrun's boyfriend had been crippled, and the state had lied about it, and she'd taken a terrible revenge. The rebellion might still be crushed. Hermann rather doubted they'd rounded up all the SS personnel in Berlin. But the state would never be the same again.
I understand, he said finally. Please don't lie to me again.
I'll try not to, Gudrun assured him.
She changed the subject hastily. Did you get Mother and the others here?
I did,
Hermann said. He would have preferred to keep the rest of his family well away from the Reichstag. But Gudrun was a known rebel, and Kurt might well have been marked too. If there were roving SS officers on the streets, Gudrun's family might be targeted. There just weren't enough police officers to ensure their safety anywhere else.
They're all in rooms in the Reichstag, even Frank.
Gudrun's face flickered. Hermann frowned inwardly. Gudrun had never liked the disgusting old man, even though her mother insisted that Gudrun clean his room every day. Frank had never been a particularly decent man. Hell, he'd been slipping into the bottle long before Hermann had met and married Frank's daughter. The wretched drunkard had been a plague on the family ever since he'd moved in with his daughter. And yet, there was something on Gudrun's face. He dismissed it. There were too many other things to worry about.
Get some sleep, he advised. You'll need it, I think.
Gudrun yawned.
There's too much to do, she said softly.
Another yawn put the lie to her words.
I have to work.
You'll be making mistakes if you're tired,
Hermann told her firmly.
You have a bedroom here, do you not? Get a shower, get into bed, get a good night's sleep. Things will look better in the morning.
Yes, father, Gudrun said. And you get some sleep, too.
Chapter 39 Reichstag, Germany, 22 August 1985.
Using Herr Krüger is a gamble, Gudrun said.
Beside her, Horst nodded in agreement. He'd appointed himself Gudrun's bodyguard as soon as she'd been given an ill-defined role within the very provisional government, rather than trying to obtain a high office for himself. Given his role, which was probably included in one of the files taken from the RSHA, he'd felt it would be better if he avoided attracting attention. Gudrun didn't seem concerned about his former masters, but not everyone would take the matter so lightly.
Yes, it is, Volker Schulze agreed.
He turned to stare out of the window at the afternoon sky, then looked back at them.
Using any of the Reich Council is a gamble. But we don't have many other experienced people.
Horst had to admit he had a point. The provisional government was slowly making contact with military bases and police stations outside Berlin, trying to build up a picture of just what was happening, and it was becoming alarmingly clear that a great many senior officers were dead or sitting on the sidelines. Thankfully, the SS hadn't quite realized just how much the Heer had focused on training its soldiers to use their initiative. SS troopers had killed senior officers, only to be killed themselves by junior officers, NCOs, and ordinary soldiers. But it had created a horrible mess that wouldn't be solved in a hurry.
"We can't trust him," Gudrun said slowly. "Can we?"
"He hasn't enriched himself excessively," Schulze said. "I believe he has the best interests of the Reich at heart. And, right now, those include a peaceful transfer of power."
"I hope you're right," Gudrun said. "Has there been anything from Germany East?"
"Nothing," Schulze said. He smiled rather tightly. "But apparently there have been a few mutinies in South Africa. The SS dropped the ball rather badly."
Horst wasn't so pleased. The troops in South Africa were unlikely to side with the SS, but they'd be reluctant to fight the Waffen-SS. They'd been fighting beside them for the last 2 years, after all, but it probably didn't matter. Getting the troops back to the Reich would take far longer than they had, he suspected. The impending civil war would be fought with what weapons and manpower both sides had on hand. Thankfully, Schulze's union included hundreds of men with military experience, and there were thousands more in Berlin, and hundreds of thousands in Germany Prime.
"I may need you to speak to the French," Schulze added, "and the Italians. God alone knows which way they'll jump."
"Offer them their political freedom," Gudrun said. "Trade that for them staying quiet for the next few months."
Schulze looked uncomfortable.
"They'll want parts of Germany Prime, too."
Horst nodded sourly. Occupied France had been annexed, to all intents and purposes. Native Frenchmen had been driven out and replaced with German settlers. If the provisional government tried to return the territory to France, there would be another outbreak of civil war. But the French would never forgive the Germans for keeping their land.
"We can sort that out after the war," Gudrun said. "Can't we?"
"Perhaps," Schulze said. "But they'd have to be fools not to take advantage of our weakness to demand concessions. Their government is so unstable that it might go under any day now."
He dismissed Gudrun. Horst followed her back to her office, then smiled as she closed and locked the door. But Gudrun seemed to have something else on her mind. She met his eyes.
"Does he have to worry about the French?"
"The government in Berlin, no matter who runs it, has to worry about the French," Horst said thoughtfully. "They're not going to go away."
"No," Gudrun agreed after a moment. "But we're not going to go away either."
Horst settled back in his chair as she returned to her desk and went to work. It was astonishing just how much paperwork was involved in forming a new government, particularly when very few of the people involved had any experience at all. Schulze, at least, had founded and run a union for a few weeks before becoming the leader of the provisional government. Gudrun had nothing more than theory and his advice to guide her.
"You might want to watch Voss," Horst advised when she read through his file. "He was always ambitious."
"That's the problem," Gudrun agreed.
She yawned suddenly.
"Everyone who climbed to the top in the old government was ambitious."
"Time for you to get some rest," Horst said.
He rose and held out a hand.
"You can sleep in the bed. I'll sleep on the floor."
"You take this bodyguard job too seriously," Gudrun said, rising. A faint blush colored her cheeks as she checked her watch. "I could stay up for longer."
"It's nearly midnight," Horst said firmly. "It's time for you to go to bed."
He concealed his amusement with an effort as they headed up to the residence level and walked down towards Gudrun's suite. Her entire family was currently living in the Reichstag, along with the families of several other rebel leaders. Horst was surprised she'd managed to wrangle herself a separate suite, but he had to admit it was a relief. He knew her father would have made a fuss if he knew he was sharing a room with her, even if they weren't sharing a bed.
"You know," Gudrun said, as they entered her suite and closed the door, "you need a shower."
Horst blinked. "I do?"
"Yes, you do," Gudrun said.
She pointed to the door leading into the bathroom.
"Get in there."
Horst did as he was told. Moments later, she joined him, and, when he turned to face her, wrapped him in a hug and kissed him as hard as she could.
Hauptsturmfuhrer Arul Falkenhayn braced himself as the helicopters swept over Berlin, heading directly towards the Reichstag. Night had fallen. Half the city was in darkness. But he doubted they could maintain the advantage of surprise for very long. There was no such thing, despite American propaganda, as a truly silent helicopter. The rebels would have to be deaf as well as dumb not to hear them coming. He glanced at his men, suited up and ready to go, and braced himself. He'd have felt better if the entire battalion had been prepping itself to jump into hell, but he only had 21 commandos and 3 helicopters under his command. The 4th helicopter had developed a fault that had proven maddeningly impossible to trace, let alone fix, before the mission had to be launched. There was no way to know if it was just another example of the demon Murphy striking at the worst possible time or deliberate sabotage. Arul knew himself and his men to be loyal to the Reich. They'd planned to jump into Pretoria after all, but the ground crews might not feel the same way. One of them might just have been cunning enough to do something to a helicopter and get away with it. 10 seconds, the Sturmscharfuhrer shouted. Get ready!
Arul stood, grabbed hold of the rappelling line, and prepared to dive out to meet his destiny. Gudrun lay in her bed, staring up at the ceiling. She honestly wasn't sure why she'd given herself to Horst. He was everything she wanted in a man, strong, capable, and understanding, and yet she hadn't been taught to be so forward as to invite a man into her bed. She had wanted him, and she was sure he wanted her, and yet part of her knew their relationship had just changed for good. Conrad had wanted to go further than they had, she knew, and yet she'd been reluctant to commit herself to him completely. Now, but the world has changed, she thought. Conrad and I thought we would have a whole life together. Now, Horst and I may not survive the month. It scared her more than the sharp pain and blood when he'd gone inside her for the first time, or the dull awareness that he could easily have gotten her pregnant. They'd overthrown a government. The Reich, a government that had endured since Adolf Hitler had taken supreme power, had been broken. There was no going back. And there was no future if they lost either. Perhaps that was why she'd finally given in to temptation. What was the point in waiting for marriage, or at least parental approval, when they might be dead within a month? She twisted her head to look at Horst, sleeping on the bed. There was no SS tattoo marring his skin, unsurprisingly. He'd have some trouble explaining one if he'd ever managed to get naked with a student. He was strong, but then, Conrad had been strong, too. No wonder he'd always worn loose clothes, she thought. Students were not expected to exercise regularly, unlike boys in the Hitler Youth. But Horst was still more muscular than the average university student. Someone might have been suspicious if they'd seen him shirtless. Horst jerked awake as the alarms began to ring, one hand grabbing for the pistol he'd left on her bedside table. Gudrun rolled over and out of bed, cursing her own nakedness as she searched for the light switch. She didn't want to run out of the room without even a pair of panties. She clicked on the switch, then grabbed for her dressing gown. It was better than nothing.
Turn off the light, Horst snapped, jumping to his feet and running around the bed.
His gaze snapped upwards as shots rang out over their heads.
We have to get to the lower levels.
He caught her hand, holding his pistol in the other, and dragged her towards the door. She wanted to tell him to put some clothes on, but she was suddenly very, very afraid. The SS had managed to mount a counterattack, even though the military officers had believed it to be impossible. Berlin was heavily defended, after all.
"They're not trying to retake the building," Horst muttered as he opened the door.
His thoughts must have been running along the same lines.
"They couldn't have put together a large force, or it would have been a great deal louder. They're just trying to kill as many of us as possible."
"Just," Gudrun repeated. The building shook violently. Dust drifted down from the ceiling. "What do we do?"
"Get out of the firing line," Horst said.
He didn't seem troubled by his nakedness, even though doors were opening all the way down the corridor.
"Move it."
Arul knew there was no point in playing games. Not when the element of surprise was rapidly slipping away. The helicopters swept their machine guns across the rooftop, wiping out the guards before they could put up a fight, as the commandos dropped down to the roof. He silently saluted the designers. The layer of armor under the stone had resisted the bullets effortlessly, as a missile slammed into the hatch, opening a pathway into the Reichstag. A second later, another missile lanced towards one of the helicopters, which exploded with staggering force. Thankfully, its complement of commandos were already on the roof and heading into the building. No hope of escape now, Arul thought, as he heard the chatter-chatter-chatter of machine guns, deeper and heavier than the weapons mounted on the helicopters. The forces on the streets had responded with remarkable speed, despite the confusion. But then, this was always a suicide mission. He cursed under his breath as he threw a grenade ahead of him, hastily recalling the building plans he'd seen. There hadn't been any time to plan a proper operation, let alone gain the intelligence they needed. They'd been forced to decide, eventually, that all they could do was storm the building and kill everyone they met. There was no way they could escape, not once the enemy was alerted. All they could do was kill as many people as they could before they were wiped out themselves. "And at least we're coming in through the roof," he thought, tossing another grenade into a doorway as they ran past. "Most of their forces are down on the ground." A pair of soldiers appeared at the far end of the corridor, weapons at the ready. Arul fired a long burst from his rifle, then hurled a grenade as more soldiers appeared. Clearly, the enemy had anticipated a helicopter attack. Although, if they had, why hadn't they cleared the Reichstag instead of turning it into their headquarters? Who gave a damn about the symbolic value of the building Hitler and Speer had designed if the rebel government was wiped out?
"Franz is hit," the Sturmscharfuhrer snapped. "Albus is dead."
Arul nodded, then hurried onwards. There was no point in worrying about the wounded. They'd all be dead soon enough. He heard someone screaming over the racket and glanced through the door. A woman was lying on the bed, staring at the body of her husband and screaming. A young boy sat next to her, his face in shock. Arul shot them both and moved on, leaving the room behind. They were rebels or related to rebels. Either way, they had been sentenced to death.
"Get further down the stairs," he ordered.
The rebels would be confused, but if they'd done any planning at all, they'd either be sealing themselves in the panic rooms or trying to get out of the building.
"Try and cut them off."
Frank Reinecke had been having a nightmare when the alarms went off. He jerked awake, so dazed and confused that it took him several moments to remember that he was in the Reichstag, after Gudrun had succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. There was no way he could ever wash the blood from his hands. He would have killed himself if he hadn't feared the fires of hell. But at least the government had been toppled. And yet, it seemed the government wasn't dead after all. Frank had never really been a combat soldier. The Einsatzgruppen had rarely been called upon to do more than slaughter defenseless victims. Yet he had no trouble recognizing the sound of a firefight. It was hard to be sure. He'd been going deaf over the last 3 decades. But it sounded very much as though the enemy were heading down from the roof. grabbing his cane in one hand and his service revolver in the other. He'd kept it ever since he'd left the Einsatzgruppen, despite his daughter's objections. He staggered towards the door and out into chaos. Gudrun was never quite sure what hit her. One moment, she'd been running down the corridor with Horst. The next, she'd been picked up by something and hurled into the wall. She banged her head hard enough to stun her, leaving her dazed and confused as she fell to the ground. Somehow, she managed to twist around, just in time to see a pair of black-clad figures running towards her. They'd seen her move. It was too late to play dead. She closed her eyes and waited. Arul didn't feel any guilt as he saw the half-naked girl on the floor, even though she was young enough to be his daughter. Like everyone else in the Reichstag, she was either a rebel or related to a rebel. He had no compunctions about gunning her down as casually as he'd killed his other targets. He walked towards her, intending to crush her neck and save the bullet he would have wasted on her, then looked up as he saw a man staggering out into the hallway. Just for a second, Arul stared in disbelief. The man was old, leaning heavily on a cane, and carrying a pistol in one hand. The moment of hesitation proved fatal. Arul heard the Sturmscharfuhrer grunt in pain as the old man opened fire, bending over as the first bullet slammed into his chest and the second smashed his goggles, slamming right through them and into his brain. The Sturmscharfuhrer was dead before he hit the ground. Arul shouted in rage, pointing his rifle at the old man and pulling the trigger. He could have sworn he saw a smile on the man's face before three bullets struck his body, sending him falling to the ground. What did he have to smile about? He turned back to the girl and, too late, found out. Horst had been knocked ass over tea kettle by the blast. A grenade, he thought. But he'd managed to keep hold of his pistol as the commandos ran up behind him. They'd been looking at Gudrun. She'd been too dazed by the impact to play dead, and he'd been bracing himself to intervene when Frank Reinecke, of all people, had appeared and opened fire, killing one of the SS commandos. Horst sat upright, despite the aches and pains, and took aim at the other commando. The man had no time to react before Horst fired, putting a bullet through his mask and into his brain. He staggered to his hands and knees and crawled over to Gudrun. She was almost certainly in shock. There was a nasty bruise on the side of her head, and staring at the remains of her grandfather, mumbling to herself. Horst wasn't sure if she liked him or not, but he'd given his life to save hers. That, at least, deserved recognition. "It's all right," he said, wrapping an arm around her. The sound of shooting was slowly dying away, although he knew that jumpy soldiers would be firing at shadows for the next few hours. "They can't hurt you any longer." But, in all honesty, he wasn't sure if that were true.
Chapter 40. Berlin, Germany. 25 August, 1985.
"There's no hope for recovery," Volker Schulze said. There was a bitter tone in his voice as he looked down at Conrad's body. "The life support can be turned off."
Gudrun felt sick as she took one last look at her former boyfriend. The medical report had been clear, all too clear. Conrad had been dead, to all intents and purposes, from the moment he'd been wounded. His comrades had done a fantastic job keeping his body alive, but the brain was dead and the soul was gone. She'd started the whole affair for Conrad, yet he would never live to see the new world.
"Goodbye," she said, very quietly.
"He loved you, I believe," Volker Schulze said. "But he would also have wanted you to live your life, not wasted in mourning."
"Too many people are dead," Gudrun said.
"Hundreds dead in the march, dozens killed when the SS had attacked the Reichstag. It galled her that she knew only a handful of their names, although she'd promised herself that they would be immortalized afterwards.
"But I will try to live for his sake."
She sighed as she turned and walked towards the door.